The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, friends. This is Larry Wilson for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Money Matters. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you articles of interest from Money.com and Kiplinger Personal Finance. Our first article from Money.com: a third of homeowners don't plan on selling, like ever. Americans prefer to stay put these days, and their resistance to relocating is contributing to long-standing challenges in the housing market. In a new survey from Redfin, a real estate brokerage, roughly a third of homeowners say they never, ever plan to sell their current home. More than a quarter say they plan to stay put for at least a decade. Only 15% of homeowners say they intend to sell within the next 5 years, and a paltry 7% expect to move within the next 3 years. This is bad news for the housing market. Given the huge amount of economic activity associated with housing, people spend money on everything from moving truck rental to new appliances when they move. That's because a key part of a healthy housing market is people moving. When folks relocate for a job, an expanded family, better schools, or warmer weather, the churn keeps the market healthy. The houses people sell contribute to the amount of available housing inventory for others to buy. Currently, there's roughly a four-month supply of homes on the market. Although the available inventory of homes isn't nearly as abysmal as it was 3 years ago, when there was a puny one-month supply of available homes on the market, we're not at the six-month level of inventory real estate pros say reflects a healthy market. Homeowners' stated desire to stay put complicates the housing market's recovery. Home builders are responding, but they can't add housing fast enough to keep up with demand, especially in areas that have seen an influx of new residents. And it gets even worse for young and growing families. Baby boomers are the generation most likely to express a desire to stay right where they are. Other research has found that large numbers of boomers are holding on to more square footage than they need, bucking the expectation that becoming empty nesters would prompt them to downsize to smaller houses, condos, or apartments, and freeing up inventory of larger homes for young and growing families. An earlier Redfin study found that empty nesters, baby boomers, own 28% of the country's stock of big houses, which it is defined as those with three or more bedrooms. Millennials, on the other hand, own only 14% of those larger homes, even though the latter demographic arguably has more need for that space. From the perspective of older Americans, it makes sense. They're more likely to own their homes outright or have a low mortgage rate they're reluctant to give up, a phenomenon known as the lock-in effect. They can push off the headache of windowing down the personal possessions they've accumulated over the years and enjoy their space. But Redfin found that the lock-in effect remains a major factor discouraging moving among homeowners of all ages. The high prices of homes is another contributor. Prices have appreciated so much that for some, even downsizing might not mean a smaller monthly payment, especially if they don't make enough money from the sale of their current home to buy the new one outright, with mortgage rates hovering around 7%. The just-because movers, those who just want a bigger house or nicer house, or staying put, mostly because it's so expensive to buy a new house. Marjorie Krifoff, a Redfin Premier agent, said in a release announcing the survey results, "The people who are selling are doing so because they need to." And continuing with Money.com, here's an article. The secret to saving money might be optimism. Although you might think that people who have anxiety about the future would save more money out of caution, that's actually not the case. Optimists are surprisingly good savers, new research shows. Pessimism can lead people to save money in fear of emergencies, but optimism has been found to have a stronger link with saving behavior, according to a new study published by the American Psychological Association. We often think of optimism as rose-colored glasses that might lead people to save less for the future, lead author Joe Gladstone, a University of Colorado Boulder researcher, said in a Thursday news release. But our research suggests optimism may actually be an important psychological resource that helps people save, especially when facing economic hardship. The researchers used data from 8 surveys taken in the U.S. and Europe that included various measures of optimism. Altogether, the surveys included over 140,000 participants from the U.S., United Kingdom, Germany, and other countries. While the survey methods of the 8 polls varied, all of them asked participants about their income and savings, and some inquired about their total assets. The survey also had participants rate how much they agreed with statements like, quote, "Overall, I expect more good things to happen to me than bad. And in uncertain times, I usually expect the best." By definition, optimists are hopeful for positive outcomes, even when it seems like everything is going wrong. This confidence that things will improve may have a link with financial planning for the better days that lie ahead. In fact, the connection between optimism and proactive saving habits was even more pronounced among lower-income individuals. For someone living paycheck to paycheck, saving can feel futile, Gladstone said, but an optimistic outlook may provide the motivation to set aside money despite present challenges. Optimism was consistently associated with better savings habits in the analysis, and the difference was significant. The researchers found that the more optimistic a respondent reported feeling, the more savings they tended to have, or in academic terms, a one standard deviation increase in optimism correlated with a $1,352 increase in savings for households with the median savings balance of $8,000, according to the release. Optimists were also found to have higher investment returns than pessimists and were more likely to have savings at all. This may be because they set more ambitious savings goals and have the persistence needed to achieve them. The takeaway from the research on the connection between optimism and increased savings? The author said optimism building techniques should be incorporated into financial education and other programs aimed at increasing savings, especially with low-income populations that typically save at lower rates. And that's a great article for all of us to take heed. Our next article from Kiplinger Personal Finance, a layer of protection for your home. A home warranty could lower your expenses for certain repairs, but you should weigh whether paying the premium is worth it. Appliance repairs are expensive, Fixing your washing machine may cost as much as $450, and replacing complex parts such as refrigerator compressors may run up to $1,250, according to home services website Angie. A home warranty could offset those expenses, but it's important to understand what it includes and whether purchasing one makes sense for you. A home warranty is a service contract that covers the cost of repairing and replacing major appliances that have been damaged by wear and tear. Some contracts also cover your plumbing, electrical, and heating, ventilation, and air conditioning, or HVAC systems. These costs aren't typically covered by homeowners insurance, which pays for damage to your home structure or your personal property. Premiums vary, ranging from $25 to $150 a month, depending on the level of coverage, says Victoria Cully, Director of Underwriting, Warranty, and Specialty Risk at AmTrust Financial. In addition to the premium, you can expect to pay what's known as a trade service call fee, which is a fixed charge you incur every time you request a service call. This fee, which is similar to an insurance deductible, averages around $75. Well, should you buy one? A home warranty may be beneficial if the manufacturer's warranties on most of your appliances have expired, or you have older appliances that break down often, says Robert Washington, a real estate broker with Savvy Buyers Realty in St. Petersburg, Florida. However, if you have a newly built home or brand new appliances that are still under the manufacturer's warranty, a home warranty probably isn't worthwhile. You should also consider whether you're better off putting the money you would have spent on premiums in an emergency fund, which would earn interest and be available for other expenses too. Because home warranty providers send service technicians to you, you won't have to worry about finding someone to make repairs. That can be a drawback, however, if you're not happy with your provider's technicians. In addition, warranty companies often impose limits on the amounts they will pay for repairs and replacements, so you may end up with a lower quality appliance than you would buy on your own. If you decide that purchasing a home warranty may be worthwhile, you can search for providers and check customer reviews on the websites of the Better Business Bureau, Angie, Best Company, and Trustpilot. Most contracts require you to wait 30 days from the time you obtain the warranty before filing a claim. This measure is designed to prevent customers from filing a claim for a pre-existing problem. When you file a claim, the warranty company will typically send a technician within 2 days to diagnose the problem. If it's a minor issue, the technician will usually fix your appliance on the spot. If more work is required, you'll have to schedule follow-up visits, and you'll be charged a service fee for each one. Our next article from Kiplinger Personal Finance, the benefits of sharing a bank account with your parents. Opening a joint account provides a way to monitor an older person's finances. According to the National Institute on Aging, 6 million Americans aged 65 and older are living with Alzheimer's disease. If dementia or other health issues prevent an elderly parent from paying their bills or monitoring their financial accounts, opening a joint bank account could help you protect them from fraud and manage their money. Most banks will allow you to become a joint owner on a parent's existing bank account. Otherwise, you may choose to open a new account. With brick-and-mortar banks, you'll usually need to go to a branch and fill out an application. Bring identification, including a government-issued ID that shows your full name and your birth date, as well as proof of address, such as a utility bill or credit card statement. If your parent is physically or mentally incapacitated and unable to apply in person, Your bank may allow you to apply online, says Greg McBride, chief financial analyst at Bankrate. Well, what are the advantages and disadvantages? With a joint account, you get an extra layer of deposit insurance against bank failure. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC, insures joint accounts for up to $500,000 compared with $250,000 for a single depositor. A joint account enables you to monitor statements for any unfamiliar purchases or charges, which can protect your parent from fraud. Although you can't limit your parent's access to the account, you can ask your bank to alert you if your parent does something that raises concerns, such as attempting to make several large withdrawals, says Cameron Huddleston, author of Mom and Dad, We Need to Talk, How to Have Essential Conversations with Your Parents About Their Finances. If your parent incurs overdraft fees, you're equally responsible to pay for them and replenish the account, says Sherry Stein, partner and senior trust officer at Plant Moran Wealth Management. And if you're thinking about adding someone else to the joint account, one of your siblings, for example, it's important to understand that any joint account owner can withdraw funds from the account at any time without your permission. Make sure that you trust anyone who is named as a joint account owner. A joint account can simplify estate planning. Most joint accounts have rights of survivorship, which means account ownership automatically transfers to the joint owner or owners after the other owner's death, outside of probate, which is the legal process to review a will and distribute assets. Note that a joint account designation supersedes language in your parents' will. If your parent dies, the funds go directly to the joint owner, even if the will states otherwise. And an alternative option. A joint bank account lets you access and manage funds while your parent is alive and will help you avoid probate after their death. However, if your parent is reluctant to add you as an account owner, ask them to give you power of attorney for finances. This will provide you the authority to handle your parent's finances, such as paying bills, if they become incapacitated. Your parent's bank may have its own power of attorney form, so make sure you complete the paperwork the institution requires. Ask the bank to keep a copy on file. And continuing with Kiplinger Personal Finance, here's an article by Janet Bodner. Grandparents, be smart about gifts. Right before Christmas, I came across a study by the Senior List reporting how much grandparents spend on their grandchildren nowadays. The final tally, nearly $4,000 annually on average. Yikes! The bulk of that went towards big ticket expenses such as school tuition or helping to buy a car. But the list also included gifts for special occasions, $400 for clothing or shoes, $300 dining out, and $300 entertainment. Of course, every family's circumstances and finances are different. But when I wrote the first edition of my book, Raising Money, Smart Kids, in the 1990s, I offered advice to grandparents in general on how to satisfy their desire to be generous to their grandkids without spoiling them. At the same time, my own children were in elementary school. Now I'm a grandparent myself. Because the study arrived in the middle of the holiday shopping season, I decided to revisit the advice of my younger self to see whether I still agree with it and whether I now practice what I preached. Whether for Christmas or any other occasion, I think the best piece of advice I gave then, and which I now follow religiously, is to consult with my adult children about what gifts their kids would like and what they would like the kids to have. Then I can choose things that appeal to me and veto things that don't. For example, I leave major purchases to Santa or Mom and Dad, unless I'm asked to chip in on a joint gift, such as the tent two of my grandchildren received a couple of Christmases ago. A number of my grandparent friends use a version of this strategy. For instance, one grandmother felt it was up to her daughter to buy a gaming system for her grandson, but she was willing to buy games. Another grandmother prefers to come up with her own ideas, but if she's in any doubt, she runs them by her son to see if they pass muster. In my book, I recommended having kids make a wish list of things they'd like but won't necessarily get, and I still like the idea. Looking through catalogs together is a fun activity, and you can make it a teachable moment by setting price limits or showing the kids how to set priorities. And the digital divide. One thing that I couldn't have anticipated 30 years ago was the challenge of the digital age. I'm willing to buy things that require batteries or charging, but I leave the decision to buy tablets and other major electronic devices to parents. I learned that my friends and I all follow a strategy of mixing it up. As one woman put it, buying games, books, and crafts to divert the kiddos from their devices. One family is planning an RV vacation next summer, so the kid's grandmother purchased games and activities with a national parks theme to keep them entertained on the road. Another thing my younger self couldn't anticipate was how grandkids themselves can clue you in to their interest. My 8 grandchildren range in age from 10 down to 7-month-old twins, and depending on their age, they are into trains, Hot Wheels, cars, squishy character pillows, art supplies, Pokemon cards, baseball, and books in the Bernstein Bears and Wimpy Kid series. All of these offer opportunities for surprise gifts that aren't particularly expensive. One of the most popular presents I ever purchased was a spiral notebook with pockets for paper. This being Kiplinger, I should also say that my husband and I contribute annually to 529 college savings accounts for each of our grandchildren. Thanks to the so-called grandparent loophole, distributions from grandparent-owned 529 plans won't affect a grandchild's eligibility for federal financial aid. Got grandkids? Let me know how you handle gift-giving, and I'll be happy to share your ideas. And again, this was an article by Janet Bodner, who writes for Kiplinger Personal Finance. Our next article from Kiplinger Personal Finance, how much to keep in checking. A checking account is designated to cover everyday expenses, so you must make sure to store enough in it to pay the bills and meet other financial obligations without incurring costs and overdraft fees. But because your expenses may change from month to month, determining just how much you should hold in your checking account can be challenging. Ken Terman, founder of DepositAccounts.com, and senior banking industry analyst at LendingTree, recommends that you keep at least enough money in checking to cover 1 month of your living expenses, plus a cushion for any unusual or unexpected bills. While you may choose to place most of your emergency fund to cover, say, medical bill or car repair in a savings account, Tooman suggests holding an additional 2 weeks' worth of living expenses in checking in case you need the money in a hurry. If you're preparing for a high-cost event that may require quick and easy access to cash, such as a vacation, aim to keep about 2 months' worth of living expenses in your checking account. Well, where to put excess cash? If you have more money than necessary in your checking account, you may miss out on the opportunity to get a higher yield on the extra cash. Checking accounts recently had an average yield of just 0.08%, according to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. You can earn a better interest rate if you transfer excess funds in a high-yield savings account to a high-yield savings account or money market account. Recently, some accounts yielded 5% or more. Forbright Bank at forbrightbank.com, for example, offers a 5.3% yield on its savings account with a monthly fee or minimum balance requirement. And as we close out our episode today, we will finish up an article. It's titled, How to Dispute Errors on Your Credit Card Bill. If you spend more than usual on your credit cards during the holiday shopping season, it's especially important to check your billing statements for errors such as duplicate charges for a single purchase, an incorrect amount charged, or a charge for an item you never received. If you see a problem, you should take certain steps to protect your rights as you dispute it. First, contact the merchant associated with the erroneous charge. Write down the date and time of your conversation, as well as the merchant's response. If you can't resolve the problem with the merchant, call your credit card issuer. Within 60 days of receiving the card statement containing the erroneous charge, you should also send the issuer a written letter that includes your name, account number, the amount and date of the incorrect charge, and the reason you're filing a dispute. Include copies of receipts and other documents that support your claim, and keep a copy of your dispute letter. Your card issuer has 30 days to acknowledge that it received your complaint and 90 days to review it and report back to you. While the credit card company investigates your claim, you don't have to pay the charges in dispute, but you still must pay the minimum due for other charges on your credit card bill, says credit expert Adam Levine. The issuer must share its conclusion with you in writing. If it rules in your favor, it has to remove this disputed charge. If the issuer denies your claim, it will tell you the payment amount and the due date. Well, we're out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. Thank you for joining us. And until next time, this is Larry Wilson. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving our community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Money Matters is also available as podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you again for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.